G'day and welcome to another installment of the Fly Fishers podcast.
Since 1967, we've been spreading the bug of fly fishing at our Melbourne fly shop.
Join us as we celebrate the fun of fly fishing and chat with characters that enjoy it as much as we do.
Whether you're just starting out or have some experience, we hope our ego-free commentary helps demystify fly fishing and inspires you to visit new places and try new techniques.
Welcome to another episode of the Fly Fishers podcast. Today, we're going to talk a bit about a bit of a controversial bird species, the cormorant. Love them or hate them, they are here to stay. And we have seen quite a few of them on our local rivers of late. So I think it was it's a good topic for discussion. So there is one bloke who is, I know, that seems to have a little bit of knowledge on pretty much everything to do with fly fishing, and that's Philip Weigel. So we've brought him back to the podcast. Phil, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Andrew.
They are one of those birds though, aren't they?
Oh yeah.
Mm. I did a bit of a Google deep dive on cormorants, and all I could find was bird lovers filming these birds and basically loving them.
So there's that point of view. if I was God, they wouldn't exist, but they do.
Yeah,
and they do perform some useful functions. We've got to admit that, like most predators. So they probably cull the weak and the sick more than the strong and the healthy, but as fishers, they're wanting to eat what we want to catch. So there's got to be a bit of a conflict there somewhere.
Yeah,
yeah.
And in Australia, are we lucky enough to enjoy a few different species of these birds?
We are. Unfortunately, one of those we're unlucky with, which is with the great cormorant or the big black or the B-52 as we call it.
Yeah, they're big.
Yeah, and some of those are huge. And of course, the downside of them being so big is that they'll eat even, you know, very decent sized trout.
Right.
And no doubt other desirable sport fish. So, they will eat, and they're incredibly good at catching trout. Mm. And other species. I've watched them hunting brim, I've watched them hunting trout, and man, they are fast underwater. That's the biggest surprise.
Mm.
You know, I was sitting on a cliff top in the Karamea once after sunset, just gazing off into space and absently watching this big pool. We'd finished fishing for the day, and this decent trout came bolting down the pool, probably 3 pounds. Mm. And I thought, what's that doing? You know, couldn't possibly have seen me. And I had sort of almost a sort of drone view of what was going on. And then the next instant, there's this giant dark shape hot on its tail.
Wow.
And it's this big black, for a moment I thought it was a giant trout. And
yeah.
it was a big black cormorant. So I never saw whether it caught it or not, but it was certainly, you know, hot on its heels.
Yeah.
And I was just amazed how fast it was swimming under the water.
How do they get that propulsion?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was
kind of like a snake.
It looked like a jet fighter, right? Like yeah. it was. It didn't look like a bird. It was certainly all feet, no wings involved.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, it was extraordinary, and it wasn't like it had done a gannet thing and dived and kept its momentum up. But it was obviously pretty much doing that from a standing start. So yeah, they're very good. But the flip side is, of course, you know, trout have evolved all over the world to avoid being eaten by these things. So they're not just sort of going to sit there and take it. They've got strategies themselves for hiding and diving and even for, you know, behavioural change to cope with large numbers of them.
Right.
Yeah.
So where are they distributed? Are they all over the country or
the cormorants?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I think they're very mobile. So they will move to where the most food is, basically.
Because it seems like you can go 6 months without seeing one and then all of a sudden they're bloody
correct. Everywhere. And you can even go years without seeing them.
Right.
Yeah. Well, not without seeing them, but with seeing very few. So they appear to be boom and bust. I suspect that might be to do with availability of food. So maybe they breed up really well in the inland when there's a lot of, food when we have those big inland wet seasons and all those inland lakes fill up and the fish numbers rapidly explode, and then perhaps when they start to dry back they go, well, we better go and try and find something else. Same thing might be happening in the sea.
I wonder if for every trout they eat, they probably eat 10 carp.
Well, look, they would be certainly eating whatever was easiest to catch.
Mm.
So if you see them at Wenderee, I guess there's a fair chance they're eating redfin just as much, if not more, than they're eating trout. You know, they wouldn't be fussy. So they're eating what they can catch most easily, and hopefully, you know, that's carp a lot of the time. on some waters at least, yeah.
Yeah.
They certainly eat carp, no question, yeah.
Any idea how much fish they do consume?
I've heard extraordinary claims, which I haven't researched because I guess it doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things because they're present anyway, but I've heard body weight a day, that sort of thing.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, they're pretty voracious and they're pretty good at it.
And I guess it's worth pointing out that it's not uncommon to see a flock of 100 of these birds on a lake somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, you see massive numbers at Eucanbeen, for example, and then somewhere like Eucanbeen, that's what they are eating is the trout, you know, because there really isn't much else.
Yeah.
Fish-wise, some of the smaller models, I reckon, and perhaps the big ones too, eat a lot of yabbies. You know, there's no doubt about that. Yabbies are a big thing for them.
Yeah.
But, yeah, if you see them on a water where trout or other fish are the main food source, then that's what they're going to be eating. They're not there for the scenery, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think is there a cycle? Or it is just the...
Oh, definitely cyclical. Definitely. Yeah. Every few years you get, in inverted commas, the cormorant plague, and it does impact the fishing. There's no doubt about it. And you have to work around it. So, you know, you got to think about what the trout are going to be doing to avoid being eaten. So one of the things that Peter Hayes and I chatted about this during the last sort of cormorant plague, because it was just as bad in Tassie as it was here, and we'd independently come to the same conclusions that you just had to start fishing different water. In other words, water that was hard for the birds to work. And sometimes that meant really shallow. Sometimes that meant right in underneath the willows and things, places where they would normally, where they might normally be happy being out in the current, aka as like the sippers we were just talking about in the previous podcast.
Yep.
They're out sort of in the more open water. Well, they're not doing that because they're easy picking. So they're really, really being super careful about cover, undercut banks. Oddly enough, shallow water, because I think it's harder for the birds to get them in the shallow water. So often when there's a lot of cormorants around, the big deep pools will seem pretty dead.
Mm.
And the shallow riffles and runs and side channels in amongst the swordgrass will have some really good fish in them because it's a relatively safer place to be.
Yeah.
I think they're at most danger when the cormorants can sort of swim really freely, and they can't do that in the shallow water. So, basic cover, you know, log jams, those sorts of things. You know, if you can, I remember one time on a river that was Snowy Creek, actually, up above the Mitter, not this season, but a few seasons ago, and we were struggling to find fish. And I found that if we fished like literally in amongst the log jams, like heavy tippet and hang on, fish would come out of nowhere and eat your fly, and you'd fish the most beautiful run and see nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the fish are almost stacked up and more predictable in a way.
In a way, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. They're just super, super cover focused.
Okay.
Compared to a normal season.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a good point, you know, when the cormorants are around, there's still fish there to be caught.
Oh, absolutely. And also, you know, big flows are good. So a sort of golden flow is going to be much less friendly for a hunting cormorant than a Hauke River flow at the moment. You know?
And why is that? Because it's still slower moving water.
Yeah, but it's faster than
a small strain situation.
Absolutely. Yeah, right. Yeah. Much more water, much more turbulent.
Yeah.
Much more in favour of the fish, I think.
Yeah. It's time for a short break to talk about the legends who bring this podcast to life. Our committed team at The Fly Fisher prepare, record and edit in-house in South Melbourne. We put huge effort in for you listeners. We hope that means when it comes time to make a fly fishing purchase, you consider us. With your loyalty, we can keep producing these podcasts and bringing you the world's best fly fishing gear. So shop smart and support the fly shop that supports you.
Yeah.
So these, these tail races are largely unaffected, would you say?
I would say so. As a percentage. So, look, all of them will be losing some fish, but I reckon big flows favour the trout over the cormorant, and low, clear, still flows favour the cormorants over the trout.
And is it a time of year thing for cormorants? Are they going to be around all through winter predating on spawning fish?
We don't know. Yeah. So I've actually, it's interesting, you know, like some very sort of reliable mates have told me that they've been sort of, you know, hounded by cormorants on the rivers. And recently I've seen very few.
Right.
So whether they come, you know, whether they've already moved on or whether they're hanging around in some places and not others, I don't know. Yeah, okay. They will go though.
Yeah.
It's always a cyclical thing. It's just like you know, everything in fishing, Andrew.
Yeah.
They're just cycles. Some good and some not so good.
Yeah. Where do you think they go?
They'll go where there's more food.
That's it.
So maybe if there's huge numbers of anchovies off the coast of Victoria, they'll go down there and feed for a while, or feed in an estuary where there's lots of juvenile brim, or they'll go to Central Australia where the whole lot of new rain's coming through and feed on the hardy heads and the, you know, spangled perch, you know.
Wonder how they know, you know.
We do. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. They must have a better form of telecommunication than Optus.
Exactly. Yeah. It's one of life's great mysteries is how they know. But as we've talked about with evolution and trout and their ability not to be seen, for example, they've spent probably, you know, a few million years developing it. So there's stuff that they use that we probably can't get our heads around. I've heard all sorts of theories, some of which seem outlandish. But one I heard was they can see the reflected bodies of water in the sky.
Right.
So from a great distance, they can see the reflection of a big lake that might not have had water in it 6 months earlier. And they can see that against the clouds. You know, there's a slightly different tone. So it's like this. It's a nice idea.
It is a nice idea.
Don't quote me. But whatever it is, they do have the ability to do it. They can't just fluke it. Like, you can't just fly into Central Australia and say, let's hope there's water when we get there. Oh, there's none. Okay, we've died of starvation before we can fly back.
Yeah.
Yeah. They must make these decisions based on reasonable intelligence. And likewise, when they come down from those areas to other areas and find food in, say, the mountain streams, then something has happened.
Have you ever heard of a report of mass starvation event of cormorants? Are they the sort of thing that can overpopulate?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think I have heard that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I haven't seen it. But I've heard of that sort of thing, I suppose. Yeah.
I think they are... you know, as I said, I went down a bit of a deep dive on Google to try and find out more about these birds, and there's very little out there.
Yeah.
There's no scientific research really on any of them.
Yeah.
You know, it's all, just anecdotal stuff rather than any real fact.
Well, I haven't researched them in depth either, but, you know, a few decades of observation is what I'm basing what I can tell you on.
Yeah.
Rather not have them, but they're a cyclical event that we just have to wear. Usually their impact is not as bad as you would think, in the sense that you can still fish, but there's no doubt they take significant numbers.
Yeah.
I think that behavioural change that the trout have as a result of being under attack is a really interesting one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, and probably stay hidden during the day more than they normally would too.
So would you move around a bit more when fishing cormorant affected areas?
Yeah, I'd be looking for those places that I think if I were a cormorant, this wouldn't be easy.
Yeah.
Which is usually places where let's face it, tight casting.
Mm.
But also slightly less so tight casting in the sense of fish being in shallower water. Mm. So that isn't such a thing that's defined by tight casting. I remember years and years ago I walked into a remote river in the Snowy Mountains, and we got there and we thought, this just looks fantastic. You know, we couldn't wait, you know, tripping over ourselves to get set up. And the first big crystal clear pool is the one we homed in on.
Mm.
And after about 15 minutes, we hadn't seen a sign of a fish.
Yeah.
So we thought, oh, we'll go to the next pool. And just went straight past the runs in between. Got to the next pool, nothing.
Yeah.
And we'd walked like for 3 hours to get to this spot.
Jeez. Yeah.
And we thought, we have blown it. And then slowly we came to realise that cormorants had been through and all the fish were in the shallow water.
Yeah.
And once we realised that, we had a very serviceable day's fishing, not off the charts, but it was good.
Yeah.
But anything more than, you know, a foot deep, there weren't any trout in it.
Okay.
Yeah, it was just unbelievable.
So just be fishing the right kind of water.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, in these events, these cycles, how long does it typically take for a river to recover?
Oh, they're pretty quick at recovering. Like, we're lucky with trout that they're a fast-growing fish and they don't like a vacuum. I mean, this is the same with bushfires, with floods, with any natural event that knocks them down. The few survivors then have the run of the place.
Mm.
So the cormorants aren't eating the nymphs and the food that the trout eat. So once the circumstances have resumed normal service, the little trout that are left can grow phenomenally fast, you know, and the few survivors have it really, big survivors have it good too. So, you know, the bounce back time is usually almost unnoticeable. You know, mightn't happen today, but it probably will happen in 6 months or 12 months.
Oh, as little as six months.
After the fires and things, it's always the same.
Yeah.
You know? People say, oh, gosh, you know, it's going to be years, you know, farewell, Stevenson. And, you know, it was lovely knowing you and all this. And then you go back a year later and there's sort of 2 pounders in all the good spots.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, that's just the nature of human behaviour and the nature of trout. You know, they're designed to – they lay thousands of eggs per fish and –
Breed and eat.
And in a normal year, most of those little eggs, let alone the fry, are cannon fodder, you know. There's almost negligible success because there's just the competition from the existing fish population is so high that they can't get a foothold.
Mm.
And then the reverse applies after some sort of natural disaster, whether that be a cormorant plague, which I hasten to add, I don't think a cormorant plague is in the same league as a severe drought or a catastrophic fire. But whatever it is that knocks the numbers right down, the few fish that breed, their babies have the run of the place.
Mm.
You know, for a year or so, they've just got first pick of the best spots, the food, etc. Instead of sort of huddling in the sort of 2-inch warm shallows on the edge of the pools, trying not to be eaten by everything, they're swanning around like they own the place.
Yeah,
and they grow fast. Trout can grow really fast.
Yeah, and that natural selection thing, you know, the fit surviving.
Correct.
Do you think the trout that are left?
Absolutely. And that selection pressure has been going on for a very long time, which is why there would be a tendency for the superior predator avoiders to prevail in those say cormorant plagues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to sugarcoat it. I'd rather not have a cormorant plague.
I know, you've made that perfectly clear.
Yeah, yeah. But it's not the end of the world for all time.
Yeah.
And even whilst there is a cormorant plague, there are things you can do to improve your chances of catching a fish.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a very positive spin. And the other one you mentioned there, the fish condition. So, you know, it's not going to end everything, you know. Get over the fact there's a few cormorants around. It's okay.
We've seen it before. Yeah. If you're a fly fisher, you just got to get used to the variability because that's just part of the game.
And adapt accordingly.
Yeah. If you want, you know, consistent fishing, just stick with the trout farms.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it does pay to adapt. And, you know, I think a lot of the information that you publish up on flystream.com, it really is geared towards helping people on the rivers, given any kind of, you know, natural variability we might be experiencing. And, of course, if you do want to keep up to date with all of Philip's writings, then head to flystream.com. But, that was a great little chat, Phil. I appreciate it. You know, cormorants, they are one of those necessary evils, if you like, that we have to deal with.
Yeah, they are. And you know, the fishing is not always perfect, but it's rarely impossible either. You know, it's usually somewhere in between.
Yeah.
And so that's got to be your mindset when you go out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So don't let it cancel your fly fishing trip, folks.
No, no, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's great, Phil. Thanks very much for sitting down with us again, mate.
No worries.